Hello, everybody. You can hear me all right?
Yeah?
Good. Well, I hope you all had a pretty good day of sitting. You're all still here. Those of you who aren't are gone. So, good. Today I want to talk about the 67th case of the Book of Serenity. The title of this case is The Flower Ornament Sutra's Wisdom. So here's the way the case reads. The Flower Ornament Sutra says, I now see all sentient beings everywhere fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones, but because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it. So that's it. That's the one statement quoted from the Flower Ornament Sutra, the Avatamsaka Sutra. And of course, I bring that up because this month and for the next few months in our weekly Dharma seminar, we're going to be studying the 39th chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is called Entry into the Realm of Reality. It's sort of the culminating chapter of this very vast sutra. It's also sometimes called the Gandavyuha Sutra and considered as a separate text on its own. The Avatamsaka Sutra, called the Flower Garland Sutra or the Flower Ornament Sutra, is really one of the most remarkable religious scriptures ever produced. I don't know that there's anything quite like it in any other tradition. It's not dissimilar from other Buddhist Mahayana sutras, only it's just more so. It runs to thousands of pages, and it includes exhaustive descriptions of the most fantastic and cosmic spiritual visions. And if you read it, it makes your head spin. We studied this before, I don't know when, some decades ago. And I remember when we studied it then, we put a little Buddha image on a table in the center of our seminar room, and we marched around the Buddha image as we read the sutra. This is actually an ancient practice of circumambulation that they used to do in Song, China for a week at a time, 7 days or more, 24 hours a day, circumambulating the Buddha image while chanting this text. So we actually did that, and pretty much it did people in. By the time we got to the end of the seminar, I think there were only two or three of us left. Everybody else gave up and thought that it was a lunatic thing to do. They all disappeared. They came back later, but they disappeared. So probably we'll do it differently this time. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. So this text, the 39th chapter, the Gandavyuha Sutra, is it's about itself about 400 very wild and sprawling pages long. And it's a story of a pilgrimage. The Bodhisattva Suddhana goes on a pilgrimage to visit 59 different sages. And each one gives him something to practice and something to think about. But in a way, that description is a little misleading because the plot is the least of what the sutra is about. And as you read the sutra, you certainly get the idea that the authors of the sutra, traditionally, of course, the sutra is spoken by the Buddha, but We know historically that it was produced sometime after the Buddha's passing. So whoever wrote this sutra down were less, they were less trying to convey teachings or parables than they were to enact an imaginative experience in those who read the sutra of the vastness of the cosmos and the vastness of the teachings and the vastness of our human life. And that's how, in our practice, we take it. We recognize that these vast cosmic visions that we read about in the sutras are actually nothing more than an imaginative description of what's really going on every day in our living. Vast space and time, and the whole of the truth is in fact right here, in every moment, in every place. That's a sort of a foundational insight of our Zen ancestors. So nowadays, you can go to Wikipedia and you can type in Avatamsaka Sutra and you'll find everything about the sutra that you need to know. It tells you everything. The sutra fully digests and accepts the Mahayana teachings on emptiness, the teachings that say that there are no separate things, no separate experiences, no entities. There's only flowing interconnectedness without essence or center. The sutra also digests and accepts the Mahayana mind-only teachings that say that there's nothing but mind, and that what we think of as the physical, objective world is in actuality a profound transformation of consciousness. To these teachings, the Avatamsaka Sutra adds a teaching that's usually called the teaching of interpenetration, a teaching that is corollary to these other Mahayana teachings, and that says that everything is in each thing, that infinitely vast is in the infinitely small, and that each and every thing is all inclusive. A good metaphor for this is Dogen's famous moon in a dewdrop. It actually is a physical fact that the whole moon, if you look closely enough, the whole of the moon is reflected in a drop of water that's just about to fall from the beak of a crane, as Dogen writes in a poem. William Blake says the same thing in this way: to see a world in a grain of sand, and heaven in a wildflower, to hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. So this is not really a theory or an idea, it's something that we can feel in our living. Maybe you felt that today somehow. Maybe you didn't use those words or concepts or ideas, but maybe as you're sitting today, you felt something different about what it means to be alive at the heart of a moment of your life. And it's really true. It's really, really true. In every thought and in every sensation, the whole of things is there. It's true. Our little lives, over in a second, are so much more than they appear to be. And what would it be like to really know that and to live as if that were true? Well, I guess there's a lot more that you could say about the emptiness teachings and the mind-only teachings and the teachings of interpenetration than I said in about two or three sentences. But I just wanted to give you some flavor of the sort of intellectual or theoretical or dharmic underpinnings of this great sutra. However, in case 67 of Blue Cliff Record, A Book of Serenity, none of that is mentioned. The sutra is referenced, and so all of that goes along with it, but that's not the part of the sutra that it talks about. It's not about emptiness, it's not about mind only, it's not about interpenetration. It's about you and me, and what is our true nature. The flower ornament scripture says, I now see all sentient beings everywhere fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones, but because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it. So that's pretty straightforward. I think we understand what that's saying. This is something that Mahayana Buddhism is always saying. All of us are, by virtue of the fact that we are animated by, or maybe you could say that we are consciousness, Buddhas. Because that's what Buddha is. That's what's meant by the word Buddha in Mahayana teachings. Consciousness, or another word that means what we mean by consciousness, reality. We are real. Don't you think? You are real. You are reality. And so, of course, you possess great wisdom and great virtue. However, because we are unfortunately or fortunately conditioned by all sorts of false notions and habits and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we don't notice this awesome fact. And so we don't get to experience who we really are. So when you think about that, the good news is that we don't have to be different. We don't have to fix ourselves or change ourselves because we're already there. We're already Buddha. We're already reality. It's pretty easy. All we have to do is lay down our various misconceptions and just kind of like snap back to what we already are. We don't have to develop a whole bunch of wisdom and Buddhist insight and enlightenment understandings because we're already that. So that's good. We don't have to do something. We have to undo something. Or maybe all we have to do is let that which we are so committed to tightly holding on to, just open up our hand and let it go. So that's good, right? Isn't that good news? Big job you thought you had, you don't have. It's easy. And isn't it a wonderful view of what it really is to be human? One of the styles of classical Zen discourse is to make fun of the teachings, to make jokes of the teachings and refer to the teachers as old broken down people and stuff like that. And so in these books of koan collections, there's usually at the end of each line a little quip making fun of each line of the teaching. And different commentators will add their own little lines, you know, to poke fun. And here are the quips to this case. The flower ornament scripture says, "I now see all sentient beings everywhere fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones." And the quip to that line is, "A bear turns a somersault, a donkey does a tribal dance." And the second part, "But because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it." The quip or comment to that line is, "False conceptions and attachments aren't so bad after all." So in other words, we might look like or we might think of ourselves as lumbering bears or shambling donkeys. But actually, if you look more closely, you see how graceful we are and what beautiful dances we do. And yes, we might have lots and lots of false conceptions, but let's not get too caught up in how false and how bad these conceptions are. Okay, they might be screwing us up pretty bad and making the world a difficult place to live in. But at the same time, we probably need them. And there's probably a point to them. And anyway, if we make a big fuss over defining them as false conceptions and decide that what we have to do is get rid of those false conceptions, that in itself is a very false conception that is going to make this job of being human even harder. Because now we not only have a bunch of very ingrained false conceptions that are causing us a lot of suffering, but on top of that, now we're in a big internal battle with our false conceptions, which is only going to solidify them and make them even stronger. We cannot think ourselves out of the boxes that we're in. And yet, somehow, there is a way. Somehow, it actually happens. I was talking about this the other day with some old Zen friends, and I got lots of old Zen friends, people who are old and Zen friends of long practice. So we were talking and agreeing that after all this practice, all this time, somehow we've changed, more or less, for the better. How did that happen? We don't know. I mean, it's not like we decided to make this happen, figured out how to make it happen, and then made it happen. No, we could never figure it out. We didn't do anything. Somehow, life went on, and we were different. If we knew how to do it, if we could explain it and show other people exactly how to do it, I doubt that it would work. So these cases usually, they're small, they're brief. That's just one sentence, but then there's all these commentaries, right? So Wansong, who's the main commentator to the cases in the Book of Serenity, he, in his commentary, as they usually do, cites another commentary. This one is by Qingliang, and this one says, sentient beings contain natural virtues as their substance and have the ocean of knowledge as their source. But when forms change, the body differs. When feelings arise, knowledge is blocked. Now, to bring about knowledge of mind and unity with the substance, arrival at the source and forgetting of feelings, I will discuss this scripture with illustrations and indications. So this is supposed to, this part of the sentence that says, when forms change, the body differs. When feelings arise, knowledge is blocked. When you look into what they're trying to say by those lines, it's supposed to be an explanation of how it is that we get messed up and lose track of our original nature. And they say it's like a very good-looking person who is convinced that she's ugly and goes around depressed about her terrible appearance when actually she's very good-looking. That's what they mean when they say forms change and body differs. And it's really true. You know, we all have a very organized set of ideas about who we think we are. I mean, is there anybody here who doesn't think that they are the person born of their parents at a certain time and place with a particular physical form and a set of mental and emotional capacities? Anybody here who doesn't think that's who you are? No, everybody thinks this. But the sutra is telling us, actually, no, that's all there, but that's not exactly who you are. Look more closely. We are seeing stuff that's there, but we're seeing it in a completely distorted light, which makes it look bad, when in fact it is quite beautiful and vast. Human beings, the whole bright physical world, is very touching. All of us are very, very touching. It's heartbreaking, really, how touching we are. When the Buddha looks at this suffering world, the Buddha does not see mean, evil people doing hideous things. That's not what the Buddha eye sees. The Buddha sees dear and touching human beings caught in a sad and beautiful trap of their own making. Maybe the part about when feelings arise, knowledge is blocked struck you. Maybe it sounded when you heard that as if he's saying feelings are a problem. Feelings block knowledge. We have to stop feeling. But in this case, feelings is almost a technical word. It doesn't mean what we usually think of as emotions. What it means is attachment and grasping. It means conceptualizing our experience rather than experiencing it. When we conceptualize our experience, we create objects to be resented, feared, detested. But when we let things be as they really are, our feelings, in the sense of our emotions, will be wholesome and pliable, because there are no objects to be grasped or rejected. And so naturally we feel joy or sorrow or compassion or wonder. And it is sadly ironic that we are so attached exactly to what binds us and makes us miserable. We refuse to give it up. It freaks us out, even thinking about giving it up. But of course, we are fully built to give it up. Giving it up is literally the most natural thing in the world for us, and we all do it. Which is to say, eventually, we do it because we all die. And when we die, we give up every false conception. So take heart, all your human problems are going to end. You'll be fine. But the point of our practice is, let's be fine while we're still alive. Let's be fine while we can enjoy this very interesting, quite amazing world and everything in it. And maybe in the process, get the greatest joy possible for human beings to do some good for others. Let's not wait for death to solve our confusion. The next sentence in the sub-commentary is, how do we do this? How do we return to our original nature in this lifetime? And this is a brief description of the essential point of our whole practice. To bring about knowledge of mind and unity with the substance, arrival at the source, and forgetting of feelings. How does that work? Not by having a bunch of ideas about it. Ordinary thinking is always dependent on division. That's how thinking works. Distinguishing one thing from another. That's how thinking and perception literally works. It depends on division and distinction. But this is the opposite. This is unity. To return to the source is to return to unity, to let go of separation. And that's the practice that we're doing in Zazen. We breathe, we pay attention to the body, and we use body and breath as our foundation. And then we allow the mind to rise and pass away moment after moment, letting go of our attachments and our ideas. And if we allow it, if we stop grasping, that will happen as we sit, and we'll feel some peace. So Zazen is the practice of returning to our original nature. That's what we're doing when we sit in Zazen. We're not even meditating. Dogen says this is not meditation. We're just sitting to resume our original nature. I think most people, whether they've ever practiced Buddhism or heard about Buddhism or not, usually when they see these beautiful images of the Buddha, like the ones we have in this room, they think they're nice, you know. They make you happy to see them. They express serenity, peace, beauty. And that's how we all look when we sit in Zazen. You can't see yourself because you're inside, you know, you don't notice it, but you actually look like a Buddha when you sit in Zazen. You look serene and peaceful, even though I realize you probably don't feel that way most of the time. Actually, you look like that. Because you are like that. But for Zazen to really be that for us, for it to really be the true and wise serenity of the Buddha, it can't be this special practice that we do on Saturdays at Green Gulch or in the mornings on our cushion. In other words, if we're going to unify, we can't have this special division of thing that we unify around. It has to be all the time. Zazen has to be our life all the time. Not just on the cushion, but every day in our daily lives, every moment, all our conduct and all our experience. So Zazen is an all-the-time practice. And this is really possible. Ordinary people can surely do this. So I'm not talking about a person who's got a calm, peaceful, serene Buddha mind all the time, walking around with a little half smile, you know. I'm not talking about that. Because as you've noticed, if you're sitting in Zazen and something disturbing arises in your Zazen, you're disturbed. And that's even more true during your daily life. When disturbing things happen, the mind is disturbed. Because the mind, like everything, is subject to conditions. So when the conditions are rough, the mind will be rough. And if you're having a rough time in your life, don't expect to sit in Zazen and have a lot of serenity, because the roughness of your life will be right there on your cushion. Because that's how the mind is. But when Zazen practice is the foundation of your life, then even when the mind on its surface is disturbed, it's not really disturbed, because the deep source of mind is always present with you. And you just don't get caught up in your conceptions the way you used to. You see it happening, and you don't bite. You don't go along with it anymore. You don't have to resist it. That's not necessary. Because you have enough strength and confidence to experience it and let it go. You're not tempted to pick it up and wave it around and start whacking people with it, starting with yourself. There's no temptation there. Because there is nothing to defend and nothing to protect, you don't feel like being defensive and protective. Actually, this is really a simple thing. In the Far East, China, Japan, Korea, and those cultures, there's always been a close relationship between Dharma teachings and poetry. Pretty much all of the old Zen masters were poets. It was part of the job. You had to write poems for special occasions. So in these koan collections, there's always a poem. There's usually a case, an introduction, and a poem on the case and then commentaries to all these things. So here's the case poem written by Hungjer, who collected the cases and wrote a poem for each one. Here's Hungjer's poem on case 67. Sky covers, earth bears, making a mass, making a clump, pervading the universe without bound, breaking down subatomic particles without any inside, going to the end of the mysterious subtlety. Who distinguishes turning toward and away? Buddhas and ancestors have to pay the debt for what they said. Ask old teacher Wang of Nanchuan. Each person just eats one stalk of vegetable. I'm sure that poem makes no sense to you, because you need to know all these Chinese references and so on. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me either, because I don't know those references myself. But I think the basic sense of the poem can be clear, so I'll paraphrase. The poem is saying, okay, folks, as Allen Ginsberg once said, this is our situation, folks. This is it. This is it. This is it. Endless sky above, solid earth beneath, and us, a lump of flesh. And yet, outwardly, as boundless as space, and inwardly, as fine as an atom, which disappears at its inmost core. We are that mystery. And somehow we fathom it. We don't know how. And then comes the Zen part, the joke part. The Buddhas and ancestors gave all sorts of teachings about this, but it was all a mistake that they're going to have to atone for someday. They'll pay for it someday. And as for us, we have our food to eat every day and our job to do. We have to live, and we know how to do it. Wansong makes a commentary to the poem, and he says this one little story about Zhaozhou. A monk asks Zhaozhou, what is the mystery within the mystery? And Zhaozhou said, how long have you been mystified? And the monk said, I've been mystified for a long time. And Zhaozhou said, anybody but me would have been mystified to death. And I saved the introduction to the case for the end. Here's the introduction, because I think now you can appreciate it. And maybe you can see from the introduction or the relation to the Avatamsaka Sutra teaching. So here it is. One atom contains myriad forms. One thought includes a billion worlds. What about a powerful person who wears the sky on their head and stands right here on the ground? A spiritually sharp one who knows the tail when the head is spoken of. Do they turn their back on their own spirit and bury away the family treasure? So this is about us as practitioners of the way. Powerful and wise. Not powerful in a worldly way, but really powerful, fully intense as we are, as ourself. No one else, ever, before or in the future, will be you. And not wise in advice or words, but wise in really living life as it is. Seeing one thing and fully understanding it and fully committing to it. The final line, as usual, is meant as ironic, but it's also subtle. We don't really need to worry about our spiritual practice or worry about the Dharma. Are we protecting the Dharma? Is the Dharma doing well? Do we have enough members? Do we make enough donations? Are there more people practicing, less people practicing? We don't need to worry about any of that. Because we don't have anything. We never had anything. And there's nothing to protect. So we don't have to worry about any of this. We're just here, alive, willing to be engaged with everything and everyone all the time. What other would you do? Until the day comes when we will enter the sky with our whole body and let go of this bright world at the very moment that we finally, totally enter it. So that's what I wanted to tell you today. Thanks for listening. And as usual, we will all discuss together this teaching. Those of you who are new to us today, I can never tell, but some of you probably haven't been here before. And we always discuss the teachings together by getting self-organizing very quickly into groups of three. And sometimes the numbers don't work out, so you could have two groups of two or a group of four, but usually it's mostly groups of three. And in those groups of three, we're going to have each person 3 minutes to reflect on the teachings and stop at the end of 3 minutes. There's a little bell rings. Second person goes for 3 minutes, third person for 3 minutes, and there's usually another few minutes for general discussion. And the idea here is, this is not, some of you here probably went to the university or high school or something where you were supposed to learn the material and then demonstrate that you learned the material. This is not that. Okay? There's no material. This is you reflecting honestly on how what you heard reflects your own life and how you might practice it and how you might express it or understand it. You're for yourself in your own way, not according to the book. So that's what we do. We try to surprise ourselves, you know, like, I have no idea. And then we talk and say, oh, look at that, I said something. So that usually happens. That's kind of fun. And then everybody else is just listening to you. Nobody else is talking while you're talking. They're just listening, not asking you questions. I'm sure you've been in discussions like this before. It's very commonplace. Everybody talks for 3 minutes, and then after that, we'll come back to our seats here and we'll talk all together, see what happened. Okay, so if you need a way of framing this, I would say it like this. How do you see the teaching of inner penetration? And I think, how do you see the teaching of inner penetration? In each thing is everything. As it manifests in your own practice. What does that mean to you in your own practice? And if the answer is, it doesn't mean a damn thing to me. It sounds like the craziest idea I ever heard of. I just walked in here off the street. I didn't even know it was meditation. What are you people talking about? Then say all that. And it'll amaze everybody. and go on with it as much as, you know, whatever you really feel about it. So whatever, what I'm saying is, you don't need to think this is a good idea. You might think it's a crazy idea, but say that if it's honest for you. The important thing is that you are sincere about what you're saying. And there's no right answers here, obviously. So, how do you see the teaching of interpenetration as it manifests in your own practice? So let's take a minute to self-organize into groups of three, and then when you're organized, we'll